actually the role of Africanism should be more central in our daily lives. And the reason I say this is just because whether we know it or not, we are all Africans. Every single human being. Because all of us have African ancestry. Once the reality of your shared African heritage settles in, if it ever does, it's important to understand African culture as well as art. If you are white, you may be wondering, how could anyone call me an African? Well, please understand that the origins of humanity have been traced to the African continent in the Rift Valley and in Ethiopia. So since we share this African heritage, no matter what we look like, it's important to understand African culture.
Welcome to CC, the podcast where you see what others see.
Hi there. Good morning. So today, what are we talking about? Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Ceci here. Is anyone there? Hi, my name is Ceci. I'm based in Berlin, and I want to welcome you to CC, the podcast where you see what others see. In this season, we're talking about movement. And today, we will talk about moving beyond race, nationality, and gender.
Our guest today, Barbara Holmes, is a spiritual teacher, activist, and scholar focused on African-American spirituality, mysticism, cosmology, and culture. She is President Emerita of United Theological Seminary of the Twin Cities, served as Vice President of Academic Affairs and Dean of Memphis Theological Seminary, and was ordained in the Latter Rain Apostolic Holiness Church in Dallas, Texas. She has worked with homeless missions, HIV/AIDS support groups, and international ministries in Kenya and Japan. Dr. Holmes has a Bachelor of Arts in Sociology and a minor in Theatre Arts from the University of Connecticut, a Master of Science in Education from Southern Connecticut University, a Master of Divinity degree from Columbia Theological Seminary, and a Doctor of Philosophy and Religion from Vanderbilt, as well as a law degree from Walter F. George School of Law at Mercer University. She is the author of numerous articles and acclaimed books, such as Liberation and the Cosmos, Race and the Cosmos, An Invitation to View the World Differently, and Joy Unspeakable, Contemplative Practices of the Black Church. Today, she has privilege of call in the United Church of Christ and recognition of ministerial standing in the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ.
What does it mean to be a cosmic being? A creature of divine light and welcoming darkness. An integral part of a universe that is rife with mystery and potential. This powerful embodiment cannot be constrained by social categories of racism, xenophobia, or sexual and gender bias. As we continue the struggle for justice, the universe invites us toward expanded options. We can incorporate the wonder of science in our liturgy, our prayers, and our politics. We are whole. We are connected. And we are responsible to and for one another and our host planet. We can respect the differences of light and dark as alternating and equal powers in the universe. And in the words of Ava DuVernay, quote, we can become our ancestors' wildest dreams.
What a wonderful introduction to your work. Such a pleasure to have you here today, Reverend Barbara. Good morning.
Good morning. It's a delight to be here.
World-class physicist and Nobel Prize Frank Wilczek argued beauty to be the center of the logic of the universe. With no doubt, whether from a religious, theological, philosophical, cultural, or scientific perspective, more and more, there is a shared view that seems to converge in the concept of unity, based on the commonality of the divine nature within and shared by all human beings. This new era of understanding of a sort of a hidden divine code is evident. Echoing this universal awareness, Reverend Barbara, in your book Race and the Cosmos, you as well address the Western cultural complexities of race and ethnicity through the lenses of physics and cosmology. My question is, in your view, which are the barriers constructed by modern culture that prevent us to understand and speak this language of unity?
That's a wonderful question. One of the things that keeps us from the unity that we all say that we want is the fact that we've decided that our minor differences are more important than our shared commonalities. We focus on skin color, differences in culture and politics, when there are really greater issues of planetary collapse, poverty, and environmental disaster. There are so many things that could unify us as we attempt to make the lives of everyone better. We could shift our gaze away from petty conflict if we really want to be unified. You see, to consider our lives within the scope of a planetary system that is billions of years old would put our race, our class, our gender scuffles into perspective. We have to realize the rarity of a blue-green life-sustaining planet in this cosmos. Then we would put ecology at the top of our priority list. Another reason I think that we can't seem to unify is that we really don't have a basis for getting along that matches our languages of victimization, dominance. We have views about one another that situate people along a continuum of aversion and attraction, and we have our stereotypes related to color. Finally, I think we're not able to unify because we're focused on all of the wrong things. We're not paying attention to the activities of hate groups, racists, terrorists, until disaster strikes. In the Americas, we don't hear the cry for attention from our children until a gun is fired in a classroom. Before unity, there has to be awareness. When we're fully alert in spirit, mind, and body, we are more than we can imagine. We can accomplish more than we can imagine. An awakening is necessary to reconnect us to our origins and to one another.
In the beginning, there is darkness. It is the womb out of which we are born. Darkness may be the blessed dimming of ego-driven striving, a destination and condition of safety and repose. In this state of trusting refuge, the light of divine revelation, which pierces but does not castigate the darkness, may finally be seen. This is a mothering darkness that nurses its offspring.
This is something written by you. Is this a cosmic metaphor about the self and our origins as human beings? Would you guide us in the symbolism of this quote in regards of dark matter and energy in our universe?
Yes, there are several places in my book, Race and the Cosmos, where I'm dealing with the widespread fear of darkness, dark people, dark things, anything that's dark is considered evil. And I tried to come to terms with that aversion by describing different types of darkness. Darkness that's powerful and good and generative and nurturing. I mean, the truth of the matter is that we have an addiction to whiteness and an obsession with light as the only indicator of holiness. I mean, religious symbols have taught us that light is blessed and darkness is demonic. Now, that's a very unfortunate turn of events, as darkness is as complex and unique as any other event of the cosmos. In my book, Race in the Cosmos, I say, yes, there is a darkness that opposes light and rejects the power of divine transformation and tries to extinguish hope and promise. But there's also a darkness that is a dwelling place of God and a comfort to the comforter, a place where the God consciousness can pause. You know, often when we hear Genesis verse 2, it says the world was dark and void. That's not an indictment. That's not a bad thing. It's an indication of the state of the universe in the beginning. And that's a natal darkness. And I call it a natal darkness because it's the womb out of which all of creation is born. It's a Genesis space for let there be and nurture. So I'm describing a darkness that's like a very rich loam of dirt that strengthens us, encourages us to push deep roots into the dark earth where we can grow toward the light fed by the darkness. There are many darknesses yet to be revealed. And in the book, I talk about dark matter and dark energy and our dark universe. For physicists and cosmologists are only recently finding out that the majority of what is in the cosmos we can't see. And they call it, because they don't know what it is, dark matter and dark energy.
So let's start with symbols in mythology and storytelling and how these stories resonate inside the human soul.
Yes, yes, let's do it.
Your explanation of the astrological blackness of the womb, space, and the divine cosmic principle of the universe, and after having gone through your work, I found the force of African history, stories, and mythology in this relation revealing and fascinating. Would you mind enlightening us about the importance of hearing the voices of our ancestries through the telling and hearing of these stories?
Oh, absolutely. My people are Gullah people, is what we call them, from the South Carolina Islands. But basically, if you tie us back to Africa, and I have done my ancestry, we are Nigerian Ibo on my father's side and Cameroonian on my mother's side. And we believe the ancestors are always with us. They're moving from realm to realm. They're escorting newborns. They're helping people to cross over to the life after life. Now, we can't see them with our earthbound eyes, but they're there. A world without ancestors is very lonely, I think. So who are the ancestors? Well, there are a lot of ways to define who has that title. Some are family members who've poured out their lives for the good of the family. They lived well and transitioned well and continued their intercession and prayers for the living. But our ancestral family is bigger than we think. The linkages of care and connection far exceed our genetic legacies. I mean, there are spiritual mentors and visionaries and prophets who impact our life through the generations and through their stories. In the recent revision of my book, Liberation in the Cosmos, Conversations with the Elders, I talk about the elders coming back to the earth side because they're concerned that the justice project has stalled. And they engage one another and a writer they've chosen on earth to encourage those of us who are here right now to continue the struggle. I want to share with you something that a writer that I have great respect for says. Her name is Sylvia Winter. She's a Jamaican writer. And she says, what if what we believe is just a story that we told ourselves about what being human is and what nature is? And she goes on to say, we're not Homo sapiens. That's what we call ourselves. We're homo narrans, not the ones who know, but the ones who tell ourselves that we know. And she says, therefore, we have the capacity to know differently and to tell the story of humanity differently. You know, our stories don't need opportunities for neat endings and good morals at the end. They just need to be told over and over again. Storytelling is the heartbeat of a community. And she says, therefore, we have the capacity to know differently, to tell the story of humanity differently. Telling other human beings what has taken place in your life is an important part of healing from trauma and can lay the foundation for new stories about what the future holds. I mean, our stories don't need opportunities for neat resolution. We don't need neat little wrap-ups at the end and morals. But our stories do need to be told over and over again.
So, and this telling of stories from generation to generation and indigenous wisdom transmitted by elderly to younger generations during a conversation with Professor Emeritus of Theology, Dr. Bruno Schlegelberger, whose academic work examines the religious beliefs of indigenous peoples in Latin America, told me that according to these observations, elderly are of great importance for the transmission of tradition, to the extent, for example, that in Brazil, the dying of the elderly from the coronavirus led to cultural death for some ethnic groups. He nevertheless pointed out that following the transition from oral culture to writing, things look different. In your view, what is the importance of elderly wisdom and what is the conveyed message they transmit through storytelling to younger generations regarding individual and collective identity?
Oh, wow. I love that question because the relevance of elder wisdom conveyed through storytelling has to do with history, cycles of behavior. Through the stories of the elders, we're able to understand how history repeats itself. Now, I'm not saying that the only people with wisdom are elderly. Because there are some amazing prophets of our day who are very young.
Yeah.
And who are engaged with the process of the betterment of humankind. In many cases, the elderly are alienated because our world is so techno-fast. And we leave them by the wayside when they are holding a repository of wisdom that would be a treasure if we could just unlock it. I think our task with the elderly is to hear them, to listen to them, and to help to release some of their discomforts when we can. To offer hope through new perspectives, because a new world is dawning, and we want the elderly to celebrate with us its arrival.
Until you know how African you are, you will never know how American you are. That is a Robert Ferris Thompson quote.
You're right.
Just a very, very brief introduction for those in our audience who have never heard of who this giant was. The late legendary Robert Ferris Thompson was long life professor of the history of art and master of Timothy Dwight College at Yale University until 2010. He was internationally known for his continually groundbreaking publications and studies in history of art in Africa and the African diaspora in the Western Hemisphere. Having his heart in African American and Latin America, Professor Ferris, who was born in Texas and was fluent not only in French, Spanish, and Portuguese, but also in Kikongo, Yoruba, and a variety of Creole and tribal languages, was already talking about globalism before this term was even considered a concept. He understood what the centrality of Black culture meant for the culture at large and as a portal to our most primitive origins and therefore an essential link in the chain of human history. So let's talk about art and the influence of African culture worldwide. Moving a little bit away from our most familiar Eurocentric view, What role does Africanism play in today's culture and art expressions and in today's daily life?
Well, actually, the role of Africanism should be more central in our daily lives. And the reason I say this is just because whether we know it or not, we are all Africans, every single human being, because all of us have African ancestry. Once the reality of your shared African heritage settles in, if it ever does, it's important to understand African culture as well as art. If you are white, you may be wondering, how could anyone call me an African? Well, please understand that the origins of humanity have been traced to the African continent in the Rift Valley and in Ethiopia. So since we share this African heritage, no matter what we look like, it's important to understand African culture and to take note of art and artists like photographer Michael Owuna. I highlight him in my book, Crisis Contemplation. He's a photographer who offers not just African Americans and Africans the opportunity to see themselves whole, but for anyone to understand their cosmic connections through his luminescent photography. Owuna calls himself an astro-black mythologist. It's a term coined by scholar Marcus Redd. What Owuna does is offer visual depictions of dark bodies illuminated as astral projections of a sacred cosmos. I urge your audience to go online and look up Michael's work. Through his lens, dark bodies become progenitors of cosmic potential. He says, my work seeks to elucidate a vision of possibility that pushes Black people beyond all boundaries, restrictions, and frontiers. In this vision, we open our eyes to the cosmic forms inherent in Blackness. And by opening our eyes, we illuminate the universe and reveal the existence of all things in their formation. So, to my point of view, what he's doing is he's transfiguring Black bodies from sites of death and state violence into transcendent forms, into vessels of eternal cosmic life. He gives us a glimpse of embodied mystery. By learning about African art, we're learning about our common ancestors. And I would encourage your audience to learn about the African desert fathers and mothers. Folks you thought were white, but who were not. Tertullian and Perpetua and Felicity, Clement of Alexandria, Origen of Alexandria, Cyprian, Athanasius, and Augustine of Hippo. Learn about the libraries and scholars of Timbuktu, of the 27 known writing systems of enslaved Africans. I bet you didn't know they had writing systems. And those writing systems include Sibiti, Ajama, Mende, Ge'ez, just to name a few. And they also use some combination of Arabic and local dialect. Then when you have more time, oh boy, am I giving you a lot of assignments. Check out Howard Thurman, Black male contemplative, who was part of the civil rights movement and worked with Martin Luther King. Thea Bowman, a Black Franciscan nun. And a young Black contemplative, Cole Arthur Riley, who's written a best-selling book called This Here Flesh. Do your homework. Dispel the myths.
I guess we got to do the homework. We talked already about the spiritual intersection of modern science and ancient indigenous wisdom and the prevalence of dark matter in our universe. All these ancient stories telling us about our origins, who we are, and where we are going, as well as the expression of this interconnection sense of existing in a sort of unity with the universe that transcends time and space. So let's go to Mambo. Now a lively dance that, in words of Professor Farris, became his ruling obsession, as it opened him the door to African culture after he first heard Mambo during a visit in Mexico City. Now, getting into this expression in art, we will hear a clip regarding a series of paintings created by Mexican painter Cecilia Rivera, which seems to wrap up all of these concepts, Mambo is the name of this set of paintings. As Professor Ferris heard of these paintings, he ran to Mexico and visited the artist at the art show, and both ended dancing to the rhythm of Mambo. I think you will find this awesome, Reverend Barbara. Let's hear Rivera talk about blood and the womb and of her series Mambas as an expression of interdimensional interaction among generations.
World that I try to imagine, what you see, what you not see, and the realities that you create. And I also believe that we live in within different dimensions also, and those dimensions are interacting continuously in our lives. And that was reflected also the way that I painted Mambo. Through those vibrant colors represented those dimensions. And for the first time, I did some kind of a figurative little bit, you know, sort of just images of men going in and out, dancing. And they were interacting into all those dimensions. And it's like thinking about the history of humankind and how we leave our imprint during the moment that we live, and we try to leave that sort of heritage for the other generations. A humongous, a huge womb, you know, that embraces with a lot of passion, with a lot of love. It signifies that. It signifies life. But for me, it's more what I'm telling you about this embracement of love.
Yeah, she talked about people going in and out into and from these different dimensions.
How wonderful.
That was very interesting because she was talking about older generations guiding younger generations through these bridges and showing them the way.
How powerful.
Yeah, and she depicted this in the Mambo. And of course, Professor Ferris was delighted, yeah, with this with this series because he understood the mythology behind it. And that an artist also in Mexico could capture that. That was fascinating. No?
Yes, very.
Hi. We would love to hear your comments and learn about what you see. Share your input at www.ccpodcast.com and follow us on social media. Oh, I almost forgot. To accompany us in this season's journey, don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And now let's continue with CC.
So let's get more into music and how it became a ventile of public theology to express protest, sexuality, and critic. Much has been written about black dance and music. Reverend Barbara, in your book, Joy Unspeakable, Contemplative Practices of the Black Church, you explore the blues developed in the Deep South by African Americans in the late 19th century, and jazz originated in New Orleans in the late 19th and early 20th centuries as authentic expressions of life. I'll say no more. Please take us to this wonderful world of public theology and despair sang through the blues, and tell us about the significance of the improvisational and spontaneous character of jazz.
Oh, yes. Jazz is a very American musical genre. It's music that expresses itself as being between a rock and a hard place, as we would say. It says through blue notes, things are a low-down, dirty shame. Jazz is a musical version of the communal response to displacement. And that's not just a black thing, because in North America, most of us are displaced immigrants, migrants, folk who were brought there, but most of us didn't originate in the North American continent. So the only difference is that displacement of the African diaspora became permanent and was sealed by skin color as a marker of permanent social exile. So there's something about improvisation in jazz that evokes a creativity. You know, it's about taking a little and making more out of it, starting with a few notes and blasting off into something completely cosmic. It's melodic innovation. Now, I have used John Coltrane as an example. I wrote an article called Christ, Coltrane, and the Jazz Sermon. And I did that because when you hear John Coltrane, you know that the notes that he's blowing come directly from another galaxy. You can hear the pain. You can hear the possibility. You can hear the neighborhood folks gossiping. You know, the straining trumpet in jazz blasts away the illusion that our upward mobility will bring us peace. Jazz helps us to perform joy when we least feel like it.
Now I need to know, how do you practice contemplation through all this activity, all this movement? In the sense that, I mean, you can hear already where I'm going, because there's this tap music playing. Could you talk about tap dance being a secular contemplative practice?
Oh, yes. Well, contemplation in the African-American context is not the sole monastic alone in his room on his meditation pillow. Contemplation in the African-American church is often communal. I witnessed that in my home church, Mississippi Boulevard, a church of Disciples of Christ Church of 7,000 members. And up to that point, I had been doing research for the books, and folks had told me there's no such thing as Black contemplative practices. You've got great choirs and, you know, really upbeat kind of music and rousing sermons, but you don't have contemplative practices. And I knew that wasn't true, but I couldn't put my finger on where you would be able to point to it until they started singing this song in my church called Oh Jesus. Well, it's not really even a song. It's only two words. Oh Jesus. That's it. And people began to moan and to weep and to walk the aisles. Some shouted, some dropped to their knees in tears. This went on for about 15 minutes while people moaned, Oh Jesus. And at that moment, I saw contemplative practice in a communal context. So, that's what, to speak to the issue of movement, a contemplative practice can emerge in the midst of powwow drumming. It can arise in the midst of the ghost dance or the ring shout. Movement is not antithetical to contemplation. And in fact, some movement evokes contemplation. And I use tap dancing as an example because I had seen Savion Glover. I don't know if you know who that is, but he was at one point a highly rated tap dancer. And he was traveling the country in a show called Bring in the Noise, Bring in the Funk. Well, there was something about his dancing that I would have to call wild and insubordinate. There's something about the movement of the body that can bring you to places that you cannot reach mentally without the movement. So the tap dancing offered a stomping, wacky, counterintuitive, revolutionary reverie. It's a dance that wouldn't compromise with the reality of life struggles. You know, it was a way of evoking the contemplative without words. There was a silence in the audience that was filled with the sounds of his tapping feet, a voluntary surrender of the audience to the moment. So they were being, that audience was being invited into a contemplative space. The clack of heel and toe against wood brought us back to a time when hush arbors held the hopes and entreaties of a desperate people. In that dance, Glover shed his inhibitions, and there was a suspension of the ordinary for just a few minutes. ¶¶
After all is said and done, the objective, rational thinking aspect of our human life is balanced by rhythmic breathing and pulsating interiority. I'm quoting you again, Reverend Barbara. Let's hear renowned artist Rafael Lozano Hemmer talking about his inspiration to create his installation called Pulse Typology, a sort of dreamlike landscape created by thousands of glimmering light bulbs, each one representing visitors that traverse this installation through the connection to the heartbeat of these same visitors. He will talk about heartbeats, the womb, music, and cinematographic inspiration, as well as the technology used, which works with all skin colors.
An anecdote, my ex-wife was pregnant with my twins, and I learned that the ultrasound machine can let you hear the heartbeat of the baby. And being a nerd, I asked for two ultrasound machines so that I could listen simultaneously to the heartbeat of the boy and the heartbeat of the girl. And they were completely different. And they were creating this kind of repetitive pattern. Sometimes they would be in sync and sometimes they would go out of sync. Kind of like the music of Steve Reich or Glenn Branca, Conlon Nankar or Philip Glass. It's kind of minimalist coming in and out. And I thought that is beautiful. We could create a concert. Not just of two heartbeats, but of hundreds or thousands of heartbeats simultaneously to create this pattern. So that was the original idea behind the project Pulse Room. It reminds us that we're here only for a little time. And, you know, as your heartbeat disappears, you know, it's kind of a nice metaphor for your time on Earth. I think poetic justice that to detect the heartbeat, we actually use light. How it works is you put your hand underneath a little camera and a little light, and then the light, the camera, detects tiny variations in the coloration of your skin. Because when you have the heartbeat, the blood flows, and there's actually more opacity in your skin. We convert these variations in coloration of your skin to actual electrocardiograms. There's one last thing that I want to mention about this project. Pulse Typology is, in fact, very much influenced by a Mexican movie called Macario. Macario is a movie by Gabaldon that shows basically a hunger, Grutas de Cacahuamilpa, which is this beautiful cave system that we have in Mexico, and where he sees every person in the planet represented by a tiny little flickering candle. So, you know, and the fragility of life is there in these tiny little candles. And for me, Pulse Typology, Pulse Room, all of these projects come in direct relation to this beautiful poetic image that Gabaldon did for it in this movie, Macario.
So do you want to hear which color, according to Rafael, is Rafael's heart?
Yes.
Well, let's just go back to our previous answer. It would be black. Because it's everything and nothing. That's what I have.
Oh, I love the fact that he describes his heart as black, because black is not an indication of color as in skin color, but a reference to the mystery of the heart. It's unfathomable. It is something that cannot be revealed. All of the secrets. Yeah, he's referencing something that is unfathomable, something of such depth, something that you can find in the work of St. John of the Cross, where he says there is a dark night of the soul, and that perhaps describing our hearts as dark helps us to understand the mystery of human life. We tend to take things for granted. We tend to focus on the material. But what he's saying is there are impulses that we don't control that connect us to one another. And there has been other research that says that our heartbeat goes outside of our body and entrains and connects to other heartbeats, just like he was talking about his twins, sometimes in sync, not in sync. So sometimes you walk into a room and you're just uncomfortable. Could it be that your heart is entraining with others who are out of sync with you at that moment? Who knows? But the research is just fascinating.
bring some more rhythm into all of this. In your book, Joy Unspeakable, you talk about how dance bounces with the cosmic. So could you talk about the significance of the drums beat and tap dance?
Yeah, you know, when Africans were brought to the Americas as captured human beings, they were not allowed to bring their drums with them. And the drums were a major source of communication on the African continent. The drums were treated almost as if they were a human voice. They would beat the drums to help the ancestors to traverse in the evenings the waters as they were crossing from this life to the other life. They used drums for celebration. They used drums as an intrinsic part of the weaving together of community. And the captors knew this and took their drums away. And so African Americans learned how to replicate the sound and the mystery of the drum with their feet. They tap danced. They clapped in syncopated rhythms. They sang songs that reverberated and echoed one another. And so you may take the drum away from the drummer, but you can't take the drum beats out of the drummer's heart. And so if that drum is part of who you are, it will be expressed in another way. And that's what Savion Glover was doing. He was tapping out what the drum would have called for. He was showing his resistance to oppression. He was stomping out liberation just as clearly as if he had had a talking drum.
All of these expressions of music, of the blues, of jazz, of tap, all of these, as you say, this Africanism, is that also like a ventile to public theology to allow us to express in ways that through religious means we're not able to?
Yeah, there are all types of means of expression. And if you cut off one type of expression, that creative energy will find its way to the public square as public theology in another way. And so the music, the dancing, I mean, if you take, for example, the civil rights movement, there's public theology and the arts in one. You march silently or you march with song. You prepare for encounters with the police by meeting in the church beforehand and singing spirituals. You have to remember that the people who were in the struggle during the civil rights movement were all different religions, different belief systems. They weren't all on one accord. It was the spirituals that put them on one accord. It was the singing of Bernice Johnson Reagan, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around." And as a young girl coming home from college, I went to the second march in Selma. And as you remember, the first march, they beat the protesters. And Martin Luther King called for a march in Selma following that march for everyone to come. And my dad and I got on a bus from New Haven, Connecticut, and rode down to Selma, Alabama. And I remember that the troopers who were there hated us more than the people who were on the sides screaming and cursing. But there was Joan Baez and Bob Dylan and Harry Belafonte. And so even though we were surrounded by angry mobs the night before the march, the songs, the music stood in defiance and as a public statement. What better public theology is there that we will not be turned around? The next day when we were marching, they told us not to sing because they didn't want to provoke the people. So we marched with our feet and the sound of our feet was our song.
And the movement could not be stopped.
No.
Because we are always moving, right?
Reverend Barbara?
We're always moving. You know, there are these cycles and these patterns, and I think that's what my generation had to learn, that oppression is not defeated once and forever. It's cyclical. It comes back again. It shapeshifts and returns in a different guise. Yes, we are. Part of the life journey is to engage in the struggle for justice.
And also, I think African music or African beats, which are very present and all times present today in all sort of music, of course,
yes,
that we hear, it also opens a possibility for sexuality, which is very oppressed by many religions, for example.
Yes.
It allows the releasing of hormones. It allows the releasing of being able to move and to share that natural force of the cosmos.
Yes. Yes, you know, in African religions, they didn't have those prohibitions about, or they did not draw sharp lines between religion and secular, sacred and secular, or sexuality and holiness. It was all a mix, you know. You had the trickster elements. You had sexuality in the dances, and you were a fully embodied person, and that included sexuality, as well as your connections to the divine.
It is a major gift that we receive from Africanism, these being able to break through this release of filling our bodies, of connecting with music and connecting the soul to our most primitive also.
Yes.
Arouses. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. So my last question is, in which religious mystical direction do you think we're moving? And would you say one day we will be able to see us as one cosmological race?
Probably not in my lifetime or yours, but nothing is impossible with the divine. You know, mysticism is important to me because it reminds me that the boundaries between this life and the life after life are permeable. That our power as human beings is not bestowed by politicians or society, but to everyone willing and ready to recognize the movement of an active Holy Spirit. So it is that movement that helps us to transcend hatred, to sustain hope, and to meet devastating violence that keeps recurring in each generation. With communal resilience and peaceful resistance, we're moving in the direction of reclamation of everyday mysticism. This mysticism is a reality. It's hard to capture with words. But you know what? I think we need more mystery, not less. We need to tap into spiritual wisdom sources. We need to reorder our taken-for-granted values. We're being called to be receptive to things that we don't understand.
And to keep up questioning, right? Keep on tapping.
Yes, yes.
Keep on tapping. So thank you very much, Reverend Barbara, for having agreed to share your knowledge with us. This interview was a wonderful experience for me and hopefully also for our audience too.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a joy.
Let's say goodbye with tap dance music while we are reminded of its underlying meaning.
I love that.
Thank you very much, Reverend Barbara.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you to our listeners, wherever you are, for having allowed us to share time with you. Shall you want to check Barbara Holmes' work, please do not forget to check out this episode's description. We will see you next time. Bye-bye.